The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
On today's show, we're going to be looking at the new public health orders restricting people to one or two buddies if they live alone, and no social gatherings at all for anyone else. We're going to find out about what that means from Alberta, from Globe and Mail health reporter Andrea Wu, a resident of the downtown East Side, and extensively covers the mental health, overdose epidemic, drug policy, and public health. And just a disclaimer for our early morning listeners, there is some swearing later in this interview. Andrea, it's so great to have you here on The Pulse on Co-op Radio with us.
Thank you so much for having me, dude.
Yeah, it's good to have you here, and especially after this weekend. We just played audio from Bonnie Henry's press conference. It's unusual that was on a Saturday, right? She's been taking her weekends off.
Yeah, so she usually does her news conferences on Monday and Thursday, and she hasn't held one on a Saturday since, I believe, early summer. So you knew when you saw that it was coming up on a Saturday, like something was about to happen.
Bonnie is not happy. And that also, she came to Vancouver to do the press conference and had just done one last week in Surrey. So this is the area she's focusing on. Why Vancouver, Surrey, and just Vancouver Coastal Health in general and Fraser Health?
Yeah. So the majority of new cases in the past several weeks have been in the Fraser Health region for a lot of reasons. I mean, it's the biggest health care region in BC. It's home to, I think, just under 2 million people. And in the past 7 days, I think it was like 70% of new cases were all in the Fraser Health region.
They're only like 40% of the population, I think, though. It's far excessive to what their population is.
Yes.
Cases have exploded way out of proportion. They were, I remember 2 weeks ago, just around 200, and people were panicking then. Now we're at over 550 or so. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what happens this week. But this new order, I think, is confusing a ton of people, including you and I and many other journalists who spend our time literally reading dense legal orders and health orders online and still couldn't figure this thing out. What do we know are the new rules?
Yeah, so it's confusing, not because it's particularly dense, but just because there was a lot announced on Saturday and there's no one document so far filled with specifics. I mean, right now the news release and the information that's posted on the BC government website has general ideas, but there are still a lot of questions from the public, still a lot of questions from the media. And so today, a lot of reporters are trying to get some of those answers. But what we do know is, should I just rattle off a list of what this includes?
Yeah, let's give us like the top like five things in there that would actually affect our listeners in East Vancouver and the downtown East Side. Like, what are some of the basic ordinary person impacts of this?
So the biggest thing is no social gatherings of any size with people other than your household. So that alone already raised a lot of questions, because, you know, what happens if you live alone? Does that mean I can't see anyone? And no, that's not what it means. So your household is people that you have regular close contact with, according to the Ministry of Health. So this could be your household members, people who live with you. Apparently it means immediate family, a close friend. It could be a co-parent who lives outside of the household. No social gathering whatsoever. So no going to each other's houses, not even hanging out on the patio for a glass of wine. No social gatherings. That's a big one.
Yeah, no guests. And no. And also, if you have a senior or a parent who you're caring for regularly, I think that counts as acceptable according to the public health office. But although it's just no fun stuff, basically.
Yeah, and so that's the thing. There were a lot of valid questions. You know, I have an elderly parent. Can I go and care for them? I don't live with them. And these things were not spelled out in the news release or on the government website. So, but yes, that is permitted.
What about restaurants? Because that was a big question, is are they still allowed to have the six people like before with contact tracing numbers? Or do we now can only go with your household and like immediate home living people?
Yeah, a lot of people were confused about that too, because restaurants and bars can remain open and it's the same guidelines, maximum of 6 people at a table. And so it seemed like, you know, we can't have people over at our house, but what if we go to a restaurant, we can have 6 people. Today, the Ministry of Health clarified that the social gathering ban applies to restaurants and outdoors as well. So if you're going to a restaurant, you can go with your household, you can go with, you know, if you're a single person with your 1 or 2 close contacts.
I think that's really important, this thing about if you live alone, you can have 1 or 2 people that you see and you can have them over.
Yes.
Just it's not a social gathering. And what's the reason for this? I mean, I think it's fairly obvious, but as far as you see in what they said on Saturday.
The big driver of cases in the past few weeks has come from social gatherings. So several weeks ago, it was a lot of, you know, funerals, weddings, receptions, and then we heard more about private social gatherings in home. So it sounds like, you know, there'd be a group of people at one house, a group of people at this house, and a lot of intermingling, and that's what's driving the most recent cases.
Indoor partying. And they know that this transmits especially badly indoors with bad ventilation, especially if people are together for longer than 15 minutes. So even if you're out more than 2 meters apart, if you're inside for a really long time with someone, it's just not safe anymore based on the latest research.
Yeah. Have you seen the modeling where they just sort of blast particles at each other?
Yes. And there's a Spanish article that actually shows the cloud of COVID particles gathering around somebody's face after like half an hour and like, how many? Basically, it means if you're inside for a really long time without ventilation, even sometimes with masks on, if they're not like proper masks, you can actually like kind of build up a cloud almost of infectious particles. Like you need ventilation, airflow, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And Bonnie Henry has not mentioned anything about like certain cultural groups or ethnicities, but like I think about like my family and like my South Asian friends where, if you have a big family, sometimes there are like 3 generations in a household. People are always mingling and it's always a house full of people. And I could see that being one of the drivers as well.
The thing that this contradicts with, or kind of is a challenge for many of our listeners, especially in the downtown east side, of course, is when we've talked to Vancouver Coastal Health and to people like the Vancouver Infectious Diseases Center and VANDU, this overdose crisis has accelerated so badly and taken so many lives over the course of COVID that not being able to see people indoors contradicts the number one rule, which is never use alone.
Yeah, so that's a great point. And I don't have clarity on this yet, and I need to get it. but what we saw in the first wave was, you know, COVID was very, very new. People were rightfully very concerned and trying to follow all the public health guidance to a T. And so, of course, that's, you know, keep your bubbles very small, stay home as much as possible, don't be mingling with other people. And that's exactly counter to the messaging that we've given out for people who use drugs. Never use alone, always come use a service, always be with other people. And so in March, right after all the restrictions hit, we had some supervised consumption site operators, you know, we have to physically distance. So some took out every other injection booth. In the Vancouver Coastal Health region, in any given week, we have roughly 6,000 visits. And during that period in March, it went down to 2,000 something. So a lot of people were not coming to these facilities, partially because there were fewer booths and longer waits, and people were just worried to be out and following the messaging.
I think most experts now kind of agree that staying alive is the reason we're doing all these restrictions. So staying alive is the primary consideration. Like, don't be alone and take that risk.
Staying alive is the goal here.
Yeah, that's paramount here, because the whole reason for this is to keep our population alive.
Yes, this is the goal. This is the goal of public health.
And we know safe injection sites save thousands of lives a year, and having a buddy with you even saves lives. Mm-hmm. Like literally, it's 100% proven.
So when Patricia Daly, Chief Medical Health Officer at Vancouver Coastal Health, when the team realized what was happening, she was very quick to get out and say that, you know, this is we need to make it very clear that we still want people to come to these sites, and that in the downtown east side, the biggest risk is still the overdose crisis. So, you know, don't worry about physically distancing at an overdose prevention site. This is still our priority in this community.
And they're super safe. Like, I've talked to folks at OPS in the downtown east side and at, Insight, places like that. And everyone's wearing protective gear. They're taking a lot of precautions to clean the spaces. Obviously, they're being as careful as they can, mm-hmm. With a lot of medical advice. I really hope that this order doesn't necessarily cause the same problems that happened last time. One of the other issues that came up, Dr. Brian Conway at the Infectious Diseases Center raised this, is in his talks with many drug users, some people had actually upped their doses partly because they might have actually had symptoms of COVID and they thought they were actually withdrawing or not getting a strong enough dose. Have you heard about that?
No, that's really interesting.
And because some of the symptoms of withdrawal are sort of similar, like aches and pains, and the difference being you don't get a fever. So that was one thing. But you know, it's a very difficult time, I think, emotionally, and people are worried about their safety in this community.
Yeah. And I mean, we're going to be learning about the impacts of the restrictions and the precautions that we've necessarily taken, but we're going to be learning about secondary effects for months to come, I think.
Maybe years, because we're talking many people have lost jobs, especially if they were already very precarious. Mm-hmm. Those are the first jobs to go often, and that's been very hard. Mm-hmm. And then you add isolation onto that, especially among seniors, either in homes or just living independently. That isolation's got to have a significant mental health toll.
God, I remember in March when everything started shutting down, I was walking through the neighborhood and like everything was boarded up. Like SROs said, no visitors, community centers closed, libraries closed, places where you could be, the Ovaltine Cafe, the McDonald's, the Tim Hortons, everything was boarded up. And it's like, if you are low income, if you live in an SRO that, you know, you're only there to sleep because it's so small and it's so miserable, where are you supposed to go? There was literally nowhere for you to go. Like, do you want me to just stand in a field somewhere? Like there was nothing. It was really tough.
We have a shortage of fields in the downtown east side, unfortunately. We do need a lot more.
You know what I mean?
It's now fast forward to now, and you live in the area. I go down there occasionally to interview people. What are you kind of sensing about the overall vibe on the street? I mean, I'm seeing a lot more people out. The market seems bigger than it has been in a long time this late in the year. Things aren't boarded up, but it does seem like there's a little bit of a hint of desperation around, and especially in some areas of the hood.
Like Hastings Street has not changed dramatically. I mean, it's as busy as ever. There's no physical distancing or anything like that. I mean, I think the most pronounced changes that we've seen are the changes to the drug supply, even in the past few months alone. There have been a few really good stories about the disruption of drug supply chains. So Wuhan, for example, was locked down for 73 days, and it was a major it's like a major city for fentanyl manufacturing. And so with that drug supply chain disrupted, a lot of people turned elsewhere, and an already volatile drug supply became even more so. This has been reflected in the coroner's reports every month, where we have a larger percentage of post-mortem toxicology tests that show extreme levels or extreme concentrations of fentanyl. There are more benzos in the local drug supply. Benzos are not new, but it seems more volatile even this year than it was last year. The price of cocaine has gone up a lot. And it's scary. I mean, we've seen that in overdose numbers in BC in May, June, July, but it's not just BC. I mean, one of the stories that I'm working on now is about safe supply and drug trends in Canada right now. And like, we're either breaking records or on pace to break records all across Canada, like BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario. Like, it's really, really bad across the entire country. And
do we have a daily number? Like, I know in BC, we've exceeded 6.5 deaths a day, I think, which is a massive increase. Like, that's like double what it was a couple of years ago when it was bad. What are we seeing across the country?
So since January 2016, according to the Public Health Agency of Canada, as well as some additional math that I've done, because their numbers were from January 2016 till March of this year, and then I got some data from March until as recent as possible. So just since January 2016, at least 18,500 Canadians have died from overdoses. In BC this year, we had three consecutive months with more than 175 deaths each, which was just absolutely unheard of before. Like, before fentanyl in the 2000s, we had an average of just over 200 deaths a year. So to have more than 175 in a month, 3 months in a row, is absolutely insane. Alberta, deadliest quarter to date, they had at least 300, I think it was about 300 people overdosing from April to June. Saskatchewan, it was 296 confirmed and suspected overdose deaths through January through to close to the end of October. And that's already a 73% increase from all of 2018, which was their deadliest year on record. Ontario, first half of the year, had just over 1,000 deaths. 2019 and 2018, they had around 1,500 altogether, in each of those years. So it's like, it's really bad. And I don't know if people are aware of that, because we certainly don't see and hear the urgency that it deserves, especially with all of the attention and the volume up on COVID.
I mean, the other thing about the numbers is that they are, it is a graph that goes up and down depending on issues around supply, but also around issues of politics and policies. And in that many ways, it just seems like when we say an opioid epidemic or an overdose epidemic, it's not just a word meaning a problem or a crisis. It literally follows an epidemic curve. It goes up and down, and it's responsive to what the government does. That's very interesting to me.
And yet, we don't see the type of response that we've seen with COVID. I mean, COVID has shown us just how much governments can mobilize when they want to. But here in BC, we've had significantly more deaths from overdoses. Overdose isn't even a right word. We've had significantly more deaths from a poisoned, toxic drug supply than we have had from COVID. But we don't see, you know, healthcare workers being brought out of retirement and redeployed to other health authorities. We don't see daily news conferences. You know, it's not being treated the same. There's a lot of criticism about that, and I think that's a fair criticism.
Being a health reporter for a national newspaper during this time, this particular time we're in, with this sort of double epidemic. Epidemics going on. How do you keep your head above water, and kind of how do you see? I mean, it's just very disheartening. So all the different numbers, and you're weighing extra numbers. We here on this show are looking at opioid overdose deaths and COVID-19 deaths, and it's just pretty dire. How do you handle this?
It's really shitty. I mean, it's really disheartening. It's clearly important work, and I'm glad to be doing it. But even with the overdose crisis alone, when you've been covering it for years, you know, at the beginning, you have this full range of stories to do. You know, what is happening? What is fentanyl? Where is it coming from? Who's being affected? What are the solutions? But when you've done those stories and progress feels really slow, where do you go from there? And so that's where I found myself before COVID hit. And now things have gotten even worse. And my struggle is, how do you keep a spotlight on news that is just such a bummer at a time when people are already going through their own challenges and, you know, frankly don't want to hear bad news all the time?
One thing that I feel like you've done so well, Andrea, is highlighting the heroes. And I know for COVID, you know, we had the 7 o'clock cheer every night for a while. We have all these stories about the frontline workers. You have also been highlighting over the years that you've been reporting on this on people at the overdose prevention site doing this as volunteers, even when it was illegal. People who are, you know, at the front lines. People like Dr. Perry Kendall, the former provincial health officer, who now wants to produce safer heroin by prescription. We've got those kind of stories. One of them I thought was really inspiring about the firefighter who decided that simply reversing overdoses was insufficient. Can you talk a little bit about him before we close? I just love that story.
Yeah, it was it's a really interesting initiative, and I was particularly drawn to it because it was something that he did not have to do at all. So just to explain it, this is Vancouver Fire Rescue Services. They respond, they are often first on the scene of overdoses in Vancouver, in large part because number 2 Fire Hall is at the heart of the downtown east side. They're just on Main and Powell. And when fentanyl arrived and overdoses started going up in BC, they saw their call volumes double and get close to tripling. And Captain Jonathan Gormick, he was trying to figure out what we could do to address this rather than just, you know, adding another medic truck to the fire hall and devoting more resources to it. And again, this is something that he did not have to do. There are people who would say that this is out of the scope of fire, but he had meetings with Vancouver Coastal Health and outreach teams about what we could do, what more we could do to address these overdoses. And so at first, Vancouver Coastal Health had given him some business cards to give to overdose patients if they wanted to reach out for services. And there was very, very little response to that. And so what ultimately ended up happening was a partnership with between Vancouver Fire Rescue Services and Vancouver Coastal Health, where they would go out together and revisit people who had overdosed in the past week or two. And they show up and say, hey, we just wanted to check up on you. How are you doing? And when I first heard about this, I thought, you know, if someone overdoses and you show up at their door afterwards, like, I don't know why, but I thought that the response would be like, ah, fuck off. Like, I don't want your help. But they've had a huge, they've had a great reception, and people are really interested in getting more help. I went on a ride along with them when it first launched, and, you know, everyone opened the door and talked to them and were interested in services and were very candid. And I think what they've managed to do is capitalize on what can be a life-changing event for people, an overdose, and to strike at that moment and say, hey, we're here. You know, if there's anything we can do to help, if there's housing, if you need a doctor, if you need counseling, we can connect you with that right now. And a lot of people do.
That's so cool. Thank you for writing that. And thank you for all the work you're doing on all these double crises. I think that you're doing fabulously as a health reporter. And I know a lot of our listeners appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Stay healthy and safe.
Thank you. You too.
And that was Andrea Wu. She's a public health reporter for the Globe and Mail and lives in the downtown east side. You can find her work at theglobeandmail.com.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.